I'm Annie, and welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. This episode is going to be a little different, listeners.
Very different. Yes. So the next two episodes are going to be very different.
That is true. And that is because Samantha and I are going to let you sit in on our therapy sessions.
Dum, dum, dum.
Yeah. We're going to be a lot closer after this.
I told you, I'm here to make friends, so you're going to know all my dirt, apparently.
Yes.
And I'm going to know all your dirt, too.
It's true. Turnaround is fair play. Yes. We're hoping it will help destigmatize therapy a little, maybe make it a little less intimidating for people who have thought about doing it and for whatever reason haven't. Because being vulnerable is scary.
Very scary.
Yeah. When we were first discussing this miniseries on trauma, Samantha and I wanted to dedicate an entire episode to therapy because it can be so helpful in learning ways to cope with trauma. And instead, yes, you're getting two. One for me, one for Samantha.
One for me.
Yes. And mine is not super intense, I'll say. And you'll get some tools for coping. Disclaimer right at the top, we know that therapy is not accessible for everyone, unfortunately.
You know, I've been there where I wasn't able to do therapy myself. Again, y'all know I'm a social worker. That's been kind of like my theme. And with that, oftentimes I could not afford it. But we did discuss with, I think we had an episode with the Kenya and Michelle about the fact that a lot of workplaces, there is a program oftentimes that at least introduces you into therapy, whether it's a few sessions, like two or three sessions that you can have, and it also counts as your work schedule. I know from my job it offers that because it is that intense, and it's an employee program. But sometimes, like mine, I remember my therapist that I was trying to get to ended up having a full schedule. So things happen. But yeah, I understand that it is really sometimes can be difficult. But there are a lot of places out there, and I'm hoping that we can get some more resources that offer sliding scale fees, which is sometimes not even good enough. And I actually try to research if there were any programs that will actually fund therapy, because I think that should be a thing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find one. So if someone knows about that, please tell me, because I would love to see that as a program.
Yeah. Certainly, if you have a job or in a university or a college or something, and maybe there might be something available that you just haven't heard about. That was the case for me when I was in college.
Right.
And before we get into this, trigger warning for this episode, sexual abuse, assault, eating disorders, substance abuse, suicidal ideation, and mental illness. And if we look at some numbers here, in the United States, over 44 million adults have a mental health condition. Though the number of people seeking help and being covered by insurance has been increasing over the years, over 9 million people still report that their needs go unmet. And there's a shortage of mental health workers to meet that demand. In some areas, 4 patients to 1 mental health worker. In the UK, in 2017, over 1.4 million people were referred to mental health therapy. And there has been some interesting recent research and conversation around the intersection of men, masculinity, and mental health, with negative outcomes like mass shootings and sexual assault and violence. The American Psychological Association, or the APA, has specific guidelines for treating women and girls, gender nonconforming, and LGBTQIA+, ethnic groups, older folks, but not men and boys. And this is concerning also in terms of the rate of male suicide, which is 3 times that of the rate of women. From the National Institute of Mental Health, men are more likely than women to use almost all types of illicit drugs, and illicit drug use is more likely to result in emergency department visits or overdose deaths for men than women. There's more stigma, I would say, around men seeking treatment for mental health, and therefore they seek help less frequently.
Yeah, it's kind of like the whole men up idea. Like,
yes,
if you're a true man, you can handle this, you can internalize this, just deal with it.
Yes,
that
do
whole,
it. Strong.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's what I sound like.
Well,
a
yeah,
man,
we just did an example of the exact thing we're talking about.
Yeah, so that's manliness, right? When we grunt a lot.
Yeah. That's all it is. there's even a term for guys having difficulty expressing their emotions. normative male alexithymia.
Oh, that's a big word.
Yeah, yeah. That is the stereotype that men don't. And in the stereotype of therapy is you're sitting on a couch and you're crying.
Right.
And so that is a direct...
By the way, crying is not bad. No. And as you will hear in my session...
Yes, no.
It happens.
Mm-hmm. It does happen. And sometimes it happens when you least expect it, I've got to say.
Yeah, true.
Recently, I was at lunch with some mostly male friends, and I mentioned that I was doing therapy, and everyone either expressed interest in finding a therapist or they were already in therapy as well. So,
which is great, because I think the more we talk about it and more we destigmatize and make it a common thing, the mm-hmm. better it is for us as individuals who can actually get help and then able to help others.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. I love it. Keep going.
And there are a lot of different types of therapy, group therapy, family therapy, marriage counseling. Evidence backs up the effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, along with dialectical behavior therapy and family-based treatment. But despite that, those are not frequently used. One survey found only 69% of therapists used CBT only part of the time or in combination with something else to treat things like depression and anxiety.
And just for a personal experience, many of the different programs that I use to help our children will use CBT, but oftentimes cannot use CBT on people who are lower IQ. Mm. And or like autism, because obviously CBT is very much thinking and processing and understanding your individual needs. So oftentimes they feel that this is not as effective for those types of patients or individuals. So just to put that out there.
Mm-hmm. And despite being a huge proponent of therapy and seeking help when you need it, this is my first serious attempt at therapy. Samantha pushed me very strongly to do it.
I would say we just talked about all the things that we want to talk about. You became open with me, and I was like, yes, we're going to do therapy together.
Yes.
But we're not doing it together in sessions, but at the same time.
Oh, man, that would be interesting.
That would be super. It could be like a couples therapy.
Yeah. Except we're not like fighting with each other. We're just like in
fighting
session
the
together.
Man. We're fighting the man is what
together.
We're doing. Together.
Yes. Right. I have gone to therapy before. I got turned in twice when I was in college for depressive or worrying behavior, which entailed going to a therapist both times. And the first time, the dude essentially told me, like, this is just going to stress you out more. I don't think you should go. And I was like, cool. And the second time, the therapist was like, I am not qualified to help you. You should see somebody else. And the third time, I went of my own accord at my mom's very strong request, but of my own accord. And I was trying to explain some of my trauma to her, and I flipped out, screaming and crying, and it scared me, and I never went back. But I knew that I could really benefit from therapy, and that brings me to one of the things I think that scares people away from therapy, apart from stigma, and that's finding the right therapist.
Right. And that is so important. And just to throw that out there, you and I, when we were discussing the types of therapists, for us,
mm-hmm.
when I was looking, I was making sure, A, that it was a trauma-focused therapist who knew PTSD, who understood triggering, who understood sexual trauma, who understood abuse trauma, because I think it's very, very important. I did look at their education level. I did look at the level of years that they practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, actually, I wanted a person who was a person of color
mm-hmm.
Because I feel like, and you'll hear a little bit on my end, it's like I need someone that identifies with what I've experienced, because I'm struggling with my own identity as a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
So it just happened that this woman, Dr. Coleman, who I know you'll talk about, met all of those. And it's been, for me, I don't know about you, it's been fantastic. But yeah, it is very, very important that you understand when you're seeking a therapist, you have the lead. You know what you need, or you know what you think you need. You need to make sure you have someone who can meet those needs.
Yeah. And there are bad ones out there. There are ones that aren't for you. There are ones that aren't trained to handle with what you're dealing with. Some areas don't have any options. I'm from a small town. I'm very familiar with that. And one thing for me, on top of all the stuff that you just said, Samantha, if it involves travel, I'm very unlikely to stick with it.
Right.
So Dr. Coleman, who is the therapist that we found, she does it online.
Right.
Very convenient for me.
Well, I was going to say she is licensed in Georgia, which that's a reminder. Each state has different qualifications and licensure. She's licensed here. I think she's licensed in
Vermont.
I believe she also Chicago?
I don't know.
Anyway, but it's been nice for me, too, actually, because I can sit at home and have my dog in my lap.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's one of the most amazing moments. Yeah,
I hug
seriously.
My pillow pet.
Pillow pet? You have a pillow pet?
I have a pillow pet. You haven't seen me in my pillow pet?
I don't think I have.
Oh, his name is Rudy or Ruby, depending.
Is it just a pillow or is it in the shape of a pet?
It's a bee.
It's a bee?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. There's so many things I'm learning about you.
I'm bringing my pillow pet
next
time we hang out.
Yes, please.
Another thing to consider when you're getting therapy is your goals. And it's good to go over those really early with your potential therapist because you don't want to go into multiple sessions if you're not going to get what you want out of it. Talking things out is great, but having stress management and coping tools is, I would say, the ideal.
Right.
And in your first session, this is what should happen. This is probably what is going to happen. It's a conversation around what it is you're dealing with, what you hope to accomplish, and whether or not the therapist you're speaking with is a good fit for helping you reach those goals.
And I'm going to throw this out there. There is timing as well, as you talked about, that you went that one time and it was not time. The last time I went to therapy was 3 years ago, and I was so caught up in all of the trauma that was happening in my work that it was a daily process that it would shut me down.
Yeah.
And I knew after a year and a half, by the way, my therapist was awesome. She was great. It just wasn't right timing, or it wasn't going where I needed to, and I needed a break.
Yeah.
So even though, like, it's great, you should definitely see therapists. Therapists are great. There is a thing in your own body, I think, and in your own mentalities, is this time?
Yeah.
Am I ready to deal with these things? Because the first thing they should tell you, the first thing we're going to tell you, is damn hard. Like, I'm going to curse. It's f***ing hard.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing else to say. It hurts.
It's painful.
It hurts. It resonates. And you start really understanding why you are the way you are. And that shock in itself,
it can
feel like it shatters you.
Yes.
The good news is you go past it. And the good news is someone is there with you, which is therapy, which is fantastic. But again, you have to be not necessarily ready, but aware.
Yeah. And able to take on that extra.
Right. So we just want to throw that out there. Just because we're talking about this and just because we want you to hear it from us, not necessarily for Annie, but for me, this has been years and years and years of therapy. This has been years and years and years of being in my field. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, in the next episode, you'll hear more from me, but it's timing. There is timing to it too.
Yes. And one thing I found from the New York Times, they had an article about finding a good therapist for you, and some questions they listed that you should look at is, what do you specialize in? Right. What kind of training did you do with whom? And what manuals do you use?
And there is manuals. There are things out there, and I'm sure this is the world of the internet, so I'm sure you could look it up too. But there are specific methods, specific ideas, and specific books.
Yes.
So oftentimes if people can't do therapy, there are some self-help books and workbooks that you can use as well.
Mm-hmm. And one thing before we finally get into this session with me, Samantha and I signed a release saying we agreed to release the confidentiality of these sessions. We did all the legal things. We protected our confidentiality while recording and editing. We set boundaries and discussed what we would and wouldn't talk about that would be healthy for us. When you're thinking in the context of other people hear
it. Right. What we're wanting people to hear.
Exactly. And we sent the file for review before we published, again, legally, to our therapist. And unless you are a podcast host doing an episode on therapy, your sessions are completely legally confidential unless you waive that.
Right. And the only reason anything would ever be reported is if you are at risk to yourself or someone else.
Yes.
Or if there's some type of abuse. So it is very confidential, even to the point that I think, I'm sure you did too, Dr. Coleman and I sat and she was like, are you sure? And we talked about it in like three different sessions about what this looks like. How do we make sure we are protected? You are protected.
Yeah.
And Dr. Coleman is protected because this is a very serious thing. HIPAA, we know, is a big part of law and your anonymity and your rights, essentially, your private rights. And it still does exist. So we agreed fully, and we'll say that on air, to allow this to happen because we think it's important that you hear what it can be, and not necessarily what it is for you, but it's not as intense sometimes as you think.
Yes. So just keep that in mind that we didn't do this lightly.
And this has been true. And this is a 6 month long discussion, you and I, of actually going here and even doing it before we were still like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is happening.
Yeah. We did several sessions like before we even got to this point.
So I think, and you and I talked about this, I thought it was very important that we set up a beginning because it takes a little while to build trust in relationships with people. And your relationship with your therapist is important and it is a relationship.
Yep. So all of that aside, we're going to take a quick break. But when we get back, we're going to hop right into the session with clinical psychologist Dr. Marissa Coleman.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Cool. How are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm good. How about you?
I'm pretty good. Yeah. I'm aware also of you being in a new space during our time together and how it's a space that's associated with work and with other topics and things, and curious how that's feeling for you now.
It is strange. I almost feel like I'm having a out-of-body experience. It's not unlike, because the show that we're doing this for, I often combine things that are very personal with work. So it's not a feeling that I'm necessarily unused to, but it is something that I've experienced before when you're like being very personal and very like yourself, but it is it is your job. It's an interesting intersection.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, just, you know, a overlap of different parts of yourself, but also different worlds. And so we'll just keep that in our minds and in the space as we meet today. Per usual, like I usually ask if there's anything that's been on your heart or your mind that you want to prioritize in our time together, feel free to let me know.
I don't think so. One thing I have been experiencing, and I believe we touched on this a little bit the last time we talked, is I just feel like now that I've started sharing this with you, with somebody, that sometimes it just like comes out. Like I'll just be talking to someone and I'll be sharing something that I'm like, why am I talking about this? And it's never anything like too... It's nothing that I feel bad sharing. It's nothing very, like, uncomfortable. But it's just bizarre because I catch myself, like, all of a sudden saying something and thinking, why in the world did I just share that with somebody? And I don't know if that's just because it's that I've started talking about it for the first time. I don't know.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense to me, just that your defenses are likely slowly becoming deactivated in ways that they had been very activated in the past. And so those filters of like guardedness, of needing to protect certain parts of yourself, like they may be more relaxed. And just like with anything, the more that you do something, the more familiar it starts to feel. I'm curious if there's a specific example or a time recently where you had that you could share with me.
Yeah. So on Sunday, I was hanging out with some friends watching Game of Thrones, and I was saying how I have a really bad habit of drinking too much on Sundays. And it's because I always call my mom on Sundays. And people were like, well, why do you dread that? And I just, without thinking about it, I was like, well, my dad has terminal cancer and my mom is miserable. And like, that's been going on for years. I've kind of accepted it. but I don't really talk about it that much. And to just have offered it that information without even thinking about it, it really surprised me. And it could have been that I had been drinking wine. But yeah, afterwards I was kind of like, oh, cannot take that back, can I?
No, you cannot. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about the person that you shared that information with. Are they somebody that's close to you in your life? Do you feel like a specific, I don't know, closeness or connectedness with that person?
I do. It's, he's kind of a newer person in my life. And that's another thing that I do love my job so much. And I'm fortunate that I work with a lot of people whom I like hanging out with outside of work. And so mm-hmm. it's kind of an odd thing where we know each other, even though he's pretty new, just because we have to work together. And then we hang out outside of work. And he's also somebody who's just really, like, easygoing. So mm-hmm. he didn't react. Like, he wasn't like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. He was just kind of like, oh, yeah. You know, very even keel. And I think for me personally, it's easier to share stuff with people who I think, like, I'm pretty sure I know what their reaction will be. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we're good friends. Sure. Mm-hmm.
How did you feel after you shared that information about your dad and your mom?
Embarrassed, mostly. Just because I didn't mean to. It has just kind of been slipping out a lot. But he was, yeah, nothing he did made me feel embarrassed about it. But I was just kind of like, I felt like I had lost control of what I would like to share. And we're still, I mean, I'm hoping that I'm not misinterpreting that we're pretty close friends, but you know, like if we've only known, it's been less than a year. So there are people I've known years and years I've never told that to.
Mm-hmm. You just said something that was interesting to me, and I feel like connects back to some of the themes of what we've been talking about in past sessions around the sense of control. Yeah. And the security that comes from feeling like you're in control of yourself, and therefore what you share with others, then also keeping your relationship in control mm-hmm. With the other person. Maybe we should talk a little bit more about other times in your life that you have felt out of control.
Yeah, there's a time in my life in particular, which I'm not even sure why I felt so out of control, because looking at it from the outside, I think people would have been like, wow, you're really disciplined. Mm-hmm. But there was a time in my life where I was just so overly scheduled. I always had something to do, and then I would get home really late, and then I would somehow find something else to do, and I wouldn't sleep, and it just felt like I was trapped in this cycle of that I had created, like this cage I had created, and mm-hmm. it was stuff of my own. Like I was deciding to do all of this stuff, but at the same time, it felt like I almost wasn't. Like it was compulsive almost, or like I just had to keep finding something because I didn't want to not be busy. I remember just feeling so all the time, like panicked, and like I was barely holding on mm-hmm. to this schedule that I had created for myself.
What would happen if you were not busy?
That's the thing. I never let it happen. Mm-hmm. I would, some nights I would even say to myself, you're going home after work and you are going to relax and take care of yourself, whatever it is. And I would go home and like 10 minutes later, I would find something like, nope, I'm going out. Mm-hmm. And it was frustrating because it did feel, even though these are purportedly decisions I am making, it did feel like there was some snap thing, like, nope, making that decision for me. I was saying, you need to go home. And then something else was saying, no, you do not need mm-hmm. to do that.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I'm also wondering if part of what was at play in that dynamic within yourself was also not wanting to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
About being with other people, but also having control over who you chose, who you were with.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there was an aspect of distraction of if you're with other people, then you don't have to think about anything else than the conversation you're having with those mm-hmm. those people. And I think I was just really looking for distraction, something mm-hmm. to keep me busy.
When you were with other people and you were talking and hanging out, was the topic and conversation mostly on the other person?
Yeah, generally. I like, for a long time, I've liked to have been known as the person who listens well, which is why this has been really mm-hmm. interesting for me. it's kind of been my thing. I like to be the person who's on the listening end. A lot of the people I hang out with are good, though, at including me in conversation, like recognizing that and being like, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of drawing you out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something perhaps about being the listener that allows you to hide parts of yourself that you don't want to share.
Yeah.
Do you think that fits with your understanding of yourself?
It feels safer for sure. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think it ties back into some of the stuff we've talked about having low self-esteem
mm-hmm.
and feeling like I don't really have anything to contribute to the conversation, or like that other person is way more interesting than I could ever be. things like that.
Do you still feel that way?
I do, but it's another one of those things where I rationally know that that's not true, mm-hmm. but I still feel that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I've done some really interesting stuff and I know that I have.
Yeah.
But then if I talk about that, then I feel like I'm bragging or something and can't win.
Yeah, a lot of self-talk that is likely reinforced by again staying in control and not sharing too much. I'm curious, when you said that you rationally know that people are interested in what you have to say and you've done some interesting things, but it doesn't always feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if, like, when you talk about that feeling, is there a certain place even within your body where you get that feeling?
I feel that way about so many things. It's almost like I don't trust myself at all. I've never really thought about it this way, but one of the reasons I overschedule everything mm-hmm. is because I don't trust that I will get things done if I don't. Mm-hmm. I just have like a really deep-seated thought that I'm not going to do what I said I'm going to do, or I don't trust the lack of trust in myself and a lot of people. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of things where I'm like, rationally, I know this must be true, but I don't feel that it's true.
Mm-hmm. As far as you can remember, when did that lack of trust in yourself begin?
I mean, going back as far as the first instance of abuse that we've talked about, I think I remember after that hearing people say, like, I remember a particular instance where my grandmother is like 4 or 5. She told me that, like, she thought I was so beautiful and she loved my hair. And I completely panicked and I had this like doll that she had made for me. I was holding it and I was like twisting it so much all of the beans spilled out on the floor. I just even then was like, I don't trust what people are saying, and I didn't like trust myself to believe it, because I know she's my grandmother, like,
yeah,
and I really, we had a good relationship and I loved her, but I couldn't trust it.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't trust that what she was saying was true, or you couldn't trust that by her saying that or about you being pretty would how do I phrase this? So I think there, I want to distinguish between two things that I'm hearing. One, not trusting something that somebody's telling you, your grandmother, but then also I wonder if there's an element of believing that by you being pretty means that something bad will happen or that you'll get hurt. Like that being pretty isn't what keeps you safe.
Yeah, I think it's both. I've said before, I definitely have like a knee-jerk panic reaction to compliments, especially about anything to do with beauty or my body.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have this, it's like an undercurrent of just not trusting that could be true. Like, when I look in the mirror, I see like a horrendous... And I know that can be true.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't trust that at the same time. It's confusing.
Yeah. Which abuse is confusing, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we're talking about is connected to the grooming that you experienced at such a young age, and the idea of being complimented about your looks as being a part of the grooming process.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes a lot of sense why, one, that could potentially be, why it is a trigger for you, but also why kind of the first seeds of distrust are really interwoven with that compliment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just said something about how I know that it's true, meaning, remind me if I'm getting this wrong, but you were saying something and then you stopped yourself and you said, well, I know that that's true, whether you're talking about if somebody compliments you or that, oh, you were saying that you look at in the mirror, you look at yourself and you don't always like what you see.
Yeah.
But that you recognize, like, there are, like, it has to be true, like if people compliment you, you know. And I'm curious about what part of you knows that when people compliment you, there are redeemable and there are great and positive things about yourself. Like, how do you know that?
I think there's a part of me that has to believe that when people that I do have been with me for years and years and years, and mm-hmm. there is no ulterior motive of, honestly, sex, or being related to me. Like your mother is not going to, hopefully in most cases, isn't going to tell you that you're ugly, but like friends and people that I just believe that they wouldn't, they might be kind and be nice with their words, but I think that I have to believe that since really for friends that they're being truthful. And because I do this show and I've done a lot of research around, you know, self-esteem and body image, and I know the facts around it. And I'm a very like rational, fact-based person, which is why I think I have this cognitive dissonance between what I know must be true, but what I feel, they don't. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, they just don't match up.
Yeah. Also, I want to point out how that disconnect between mind and body is a very common symptom for survivors of abuse and trauma. Is this idea of, particularly when it's involving sexual body parts, because the feeling itself can be confusing and that sometimes is pleasurable, but then in your mind or even in your heart, you're like, but this isn't right and I don't feel good. And this is, you know, all of the, insert whatever adjective you want, you know. And so that in itself is confusing.
Yeah.
And so it's easy for that to, that interaction to spill over to other areas of life too.
Mm-hmm.
So I know for us, one of our tasks is how to integrate that more for you.
Yeah.
So that one, you can safely rely on your intuition and instincts and gut reactions of if somebody does say something that's disingenuous, that you can trust your ability to sense that and know that.
Mm-hmm.
And then vice versa, when somebody is sincere and authentic with you, that you can trust that too.
Mm-hmm.
What I heard you saying was that time and consistency with people in your life, like that helps build that sense of trust.
Mm-hmm. We have a little bit more for you listeners, but we're going to pause for one more quick break for word from our sponsor.
Has there ever been a time when you have gone with a gut instinct, whether it was early on in a relationship and it ended up being correct, like you, and you were either surprised by that or like, do you have any experience of that?
No, not personally, but I can see it in other people's relationships, which is the last thing anyone wants. But I have a friend in particular where several times I've been like, this person is no good for you. Mm. And I usually don't, unless they ask, like, or I'm very concerned, I'm not going to voice that. So I feel like sometimes I can see it in other people. I think I've often felt it in my own relationships, but I usually convince myself that I'm being, I guess, paranoid or... It's difficult for me because I've never really had I don't remember too much a time before I had like traumatic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of times I'm thinking maybe this is normal and I'm just being like overly sensitive to it. So I'll definitely stay in relationships long past when I think this is not going to work.
Okay. So you start to second guess yourself and doubt your ability to discern and know what's right for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is it that keeps you there? You had mentioned something about how you may like minimize your feelings or brush it off as like, oh, I'm just being too sensitive. But are there other things that keep you in a situation that you don't feel like is great for you?
I don't want to hurt the other person's feelings a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I'm very bad about letting people, I don't want to let anybody down. I don't want to make anyone unhappy. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a sense of like, well, this person is willing to be with you. And they still are. So maybe you should see if you can make it work, because who knows if there's another person like that out there.
Mm. Saying that out loud, how does that feel?
It's sad. I mean, I've never, this isn't a surprise to me at all. I often think that. But mm-hmm. yeah, saying it out loud is, it makes me sad.
Yeah, because I can see the emotion when you talk about it. Looks like a lot of sadness.
Yeah.
Is that something that you would like to see shift in your life, in your own self-perception?
Yeah. I just feel like there's so many threads for me to, like, so many things I need to tackle mm-hmm. before I can even, like, ascertain what I want. I don't even know what I want.
Yeah.
And I would like to be able to say confidently, this relationship isn't good for me, or no relationship is good for me, or mm-hmm. without always wondering, is it because I went through these traumatic things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just compelling to me to hear, because it's another way that the traumatic experiences you've had continue to have a hold on not just you and how you view yourself, but also like your life, mm-hmm. you know, in the near future, you know, essentially. Yeah, which is why I think it's just so brave of you to work on this stuff and to talk about this, because for so long, it's kind of been this like dark passenger, for lack of a better word, with you. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. Something that you carry that you don't share, but like that impacts you and every aspect of your life.
Yeah.
And it also keeps you from your goal of like authentic connection mm-hmm. and to be seen and known by another person.
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many things that I have done for so long that I had not realized that I was doing just mm-hmm. to cope and to avoid and to not have to deal with it.
Right, and we've talked about how that's adaptive, right? Mm-hmm. Until you're in situations that are safe and that don't need that hypervigilance, you know, mm-hmm. to keep you safe. And then it becomes unhelpful and it can keep you from your goals for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you are at that place where you are safe?
I think, yes. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where I think I am safe, and I feel pretty safe most of the time. But then I have days where I really don't. And I mean, the compliment thing is a great example. Like in any relationship that in theory you're going to like date, and someone gives you a compliment, the amount of like, I've got to get out of here right now that I feel, it makes me so uncomfortable. And it's like panic. I remember somebody was like getting ready to compliment me, and I was like, stop. So it's another thing where I'm pretty sure that I am safe, but I don't always feel safe.
Yeah. Really great distinction, because again, that gets at like the mind and the body and the disconnect, right? Mm-hmm. You may not feel safe in your body because you're being triggered.
Mm-hmm.
But your mind and the reality of the situation, you likely are safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always that risk, especially when you're in a relationship with another person and you're getting to know that person, the what if. And that's the thing about triggers and why they can have a really powerful hold on anyone's way of being and of functioning, is that there was a time when you were safe at preschool and you did feel safe at preschool until the first abuse instance, and then you were no longer safe. You know what I mean? Or the grooming started and you started to get that kind of prickly feeling, or the hair on your arms, or like that icky feeling in your tummy of like, why is he sitting so close to me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're triggered by a compliment, it likely brings you back to those feelings when you were a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Have we done a writing exercise yet together? Have I asked you to do it? I don't think I have, but I'm thinking it may be helpful if you're up for it and interested. Feel free to say no. But writing a letter to little Annie, to you as a little girl, during that first instance of abuse,
mm-hmm.
and what you would like to say to her. Or even thinking about what she needs,
mm-hmm.
or what you would have wanted. I think that could be a powerful exercise to kind of get in tune with, like, one, you're not that little girl anymore,
mm-hmm.
But also still, you're still so closely connected.
Yeah. It's really interesting to me that suggestion. I do think it'd be really powerful, because I've told you before, I have this character that I wrote that I later realized she was like my trauma personified. Mm-hmm. And one night I couldn't sleep, and I wrote a letter to her apologizing to her for what I had done to her in the writing.
Oh, wow.
And it was really moving, and she's a fictional character, but I bet that would be pretty powerful for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if you do that and feel like you want to include that or involve that in your therapy, that would be great to hear and for you to share. Also, the character, I know we've talked about her a bit. Feel free to include her and bring her in too anytime.
Don't tempt me.
I would love it. Yeah, I love narrative work, because I think it's just a really powerful way to do post-traumatic healing, especially at the beginning, when the exposure of talking about your own experiences can be almost too much.
Mm-hmm.
It can feel safer for many to share and to talk through a character.
Yeah.
Going back to what we were talking about you over-scheduling yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Did we chat about what you were afraid of if you weren't as scheduled? Like what would happen?
I have this if I sit still too long with myself, I would describe it as like a like itching. I just get really uncomfortable, and then I get like this like gnawing anxiety of you should be doing something. You should be doing something. And it's something that I also experience when I try to sleep. Mm-hmm. And I think I am just afraid of where my thoughts will go if I don't occupy them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, most of the time, even when I can't sleep, it's fine. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not great, but I can't sleep. But there's no like flashback happening or anything mm-hmm. like that. But sometimes there are. And I think that those times are powerful enough that I will do what I have to, what I think will be my best bet to prevent them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm just really uncomfortable in my own skin. Mm-hmm. And I like to have distraction from it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're almost like a different person when you're around other people?
Yeah. Yeah. What did my boyfriend used to say? Like, my greatest skill was pretending everything was okay. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm around other people, I'm just very, like, happy. I'm like, happy and I laugh. Well, all my nicknames are based mm-hmm. around laughter almost. Yeah. And then when I'm by myself, it's like the opposite end of the spectrum. And I've gotten better. I've gotten better about being like with myself, by myself. Because mm-hmm. Eventually I had to. Like I was crashing hard. That was one of the things where I knew that I probably needed to go get therapy. But yeah, I think I am. When I'm out with people, I'm much more like lighter.
And that's because of the distraction?
I think so. And I think there's also an element of having, you know, you have that social persona. Mm-hmm. And my social persona is that she's like... like another person. I am like very I'm fun and outgoing, and I'm always down to hang, and I've always got like jokes and puns, and I'm just fun. And I think there is a defense around that too, where I have that underlying sense of when people realize what you really are, they'll never want to hang out with you. But mm-hmm. if you're super fun, mm-hmm. then they'll always like invite you to stuff. They'll want to hang out mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like performing.
Mm. That was the sense that I was getting. You know, and a lot of performers talk about this idea of having a persona, and then when they are out of the spotlight, so to speak, or their cameras aren't rolling, right? Then there's this lull of, you know, who am I if I'm not engaging with people in ways that are expected of me? You know, there's like an identity that's formed around how other people perceive you. Mm-hmm. How do you think that tendency within yourself connects to your traumatic experiences? Or if you think that it does at all, actually?
I think the the closest way that it does is probably mainly my desire that to not make people uncomfortable or sad, to protect people and make them happy, and in doing so, not sharing that with people, not sharing what happened to me with people that are close to me, like pretending everything is okay so that they don't have to worry about it or feel bad about it.
So to protect others at the sake of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even, you know, when you're trying to cope yourself, you don't want to admit that this has happened to you. Like, there's even an element of that, of like, if I can almost pretend I am this person, and then I don't have to feel like that vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And that feeling that, oh, I am not over it. There's something very alluring about, you know what, this happened to me, but I'm the life of the party. But yeah, eventually you have to go home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing about denial, it being one of the most primitive defenses, right? Is that it can only work for so long.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about trauma, you know, and whether it's denial, avoidance, or dissociation, or all of the above, it will find a way to come out and manifest itself. You know, which is why trauma-focused work can be so scary, because it removes that defense. But also, that's the same reason why it's really powerful, because it has the ability to get to the root of the issue so that it can be less poignant and impactful on one's life. And just talking about it like you're doing is a really big part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. It's been, I don't, it does feel like I have, there's almost two people that are living inside of me. Just so, it sounds weird to say, but I do feel like there's the one that most people know. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other one.
Yeah. And the other one is hidden because out of, is the other one hidden out of fear that the people close to you would not be there for you, or would look at you differently if they knew?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a pretty decent amount of fear that when you make people uncomfortable, or if they see, they hear these things about you and they're thinking, oh man, I don't know if I want to have to deal with this. And that's being really to my friends. I'm fairly confident. I'm almost, you know, it's me. I'm the one that is uncomfortable with being open with that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even just saying that, there's a lot of emotion in that statement, I can see. What makes you the most uncomfortable about that, do you think?
I think it makes it real. It makes it like I can't, that's another thing I can't take back. And it also, I have built myself on making people happy and on also being strong. It feels like admitting I was weak. And there are certain things that I think people find funny about me that I think if they knew the source was from traumatic experience, they would feel guilty. And also, like, so for example, I'm very easily startled. It's kind of like a joke. And it doesn't upset me. Like, I'm not saying this to, but I'm worried that every time someone startled me who knew that after the fact,
right,
like, there would be this moment of like, oh yeah, that thing happened to you.
Right. So part of what I hear you saying is that you feel like if people knew, then they would start to think of you as either a victim or as they think about the abuse when thinking about you. Is that part of what I hear you saying?
Yeah.
Right. And that you want to be known for so many other things. Yeah. Rightfully so.
Yeah.
I can understand that fear 100%. I think that's also tied into what you said about how you feel like people would think of you as weak. You know, and I think that, you know, we've talked a bit about like unhelpful, like cognitions and kind of unhelpful core beliefs around the trauma that have been internalized that we'll do some work on externalizing and then restoring through narrative work. But this idea that trauma makes somebody weak is one that I know is a recurring theme in our work together and that I hear you talk about in regards to yourself versus, which is the same as like the victim versus survivor, right?
Yeah.
When in fact, it was actually your resilience and your strength that allowed you to continue to persevere and thrive. And there's an element too of a survivor taking on the persona or the identity of weakness that absolves the offender of all of the responsibility.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, just throwing that out there. Not much that we have to do with that now, but bookmarking some things to make sure that we address and come back to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I told you before, I on days where I like can feel compassion for my younger self.
Yeah.
Because she does feel like a younger sister. She doesn't feel like me at all. But sometimes I'm like in awe of what she dealt with.
Yeah. My hope for you is that you can sit in that sense of awe and let that permeate you more. Because when I sit with you and when I talk with you and see you, that's what I see. And I'm sure that the people in your life that love you and that are close with you see the same thing. So why don't this week, we're going to have to pause in a moment, but why don't this week you try to approach some of that self-compassion with intentionality, and even if it's just a moment every day. thinking through and reflecting something that you are in awe of about yourself.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about that next session.
Okay. Homework. Perfect.
Yeah.
And that's that. That's what therapy can look like. I never really know how these are going to go. I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I knew what I wouldn't talk about.
Right.
But I believe me, I had that is the last thing I thought I was going to get
and,
into.
And just so you know, I was not present for this. Our producer, Andrew, who is fantastic, was not present for this because we wanted you to be in your safe, in your place and make it normal as possible with headphones and mic.
Yeah, and a mic. Yep.
I mean, I will say for me, it felt normal.
It did, yeah.
But yeah, that was something, like even though we're here talking about it, obviously, it was done in a private manner and there are things we may have taken out or put up, put together, whatever, not necessarily rearranged, but put together because we felt it was important. So, again, we were still protecting our own selves and our own emotions and our own mentality, mental health.
Yes.
So, just again.
Yeah. And one thing I did want to mention that I have really appreciated about doing these sessions with Dr. Coleman is she gives me a lot of tools, like coping tools. Like safe place, measuring distress units. We'll probably come back and talk about those in future episodes. And one thing I found interesting after listening back to this is I really played it safe. I wanted to play it safe. I didn't want to get into details of my abuse. But at the same time, there was something she asked me where I didn't even think about the abuse and I should have. Like there's this question around control. And if I imagine my brain is Google and she's giving me a search term, it's like those sections of my life are blocked results. They didn't even appear until later. And I was thinking about it like,
You had one of those aha moments.
Mm-hmm. My denial game is very strong. and not that the answer I gave wasn't true. It's very true. But it's just not the obvious choice at all. But yeah, I hope that if you've ever thought you were the only one that had these very severe insecurities and low self-esteem, I present proof that you are not.
I think you and I had already talked about the fact that we both had a session about being, feeling like we had the imposter syndrome.
Yes.
And specifically about this podcast, I think.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yep. But, yeah, we hope that this has made it less scary, maybe helped destigmatize it a little for you listeners, and you will be hearing Samantha's in the next episode. But in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us, Samantha.
Yeah, thank you guys for letting me be a part of this.
Yeah, and thanks to Dr. Coleman who agreed to do this after months of careful thought.
So if you're in Georgia or in Vermont and you can't afford therapy, she is fantastic. Thus far, she has called me out on a lot of things.
Which is...
in a good way.
Yes, in a good way. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Andrew Howard.
Andrew, we love you.
We do. And thanks to you for listening. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is momstuff@howstuffworks.com. You can also find us on Twitter at @MomStuffPodcast and on Instagram at @StuffMomNeverToldYou.
Give us the resources.
Stuff Mom Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.